ones, like cinema and literature, could never make the leap from idea to reality without a sizable investment from the outside anyway. Writers routinely mail out manuscripts and leave virtually all that follows, proofreading, design, printing, distribution, and promotion, in the publisher's hands. Some artists even make the interface a prominent part of their work. Christo's various wrappings are a form of performance art experienced directly by relatively few people. But the record of the performance has become its own art piece, exhibited in museums complete with maps, working drawings, correspondence with zoning boards, logistical plans, and so on. If all this evidence of the reach of today's arts network still fails to impress you, consider the sobering corollary. Once you are dead, all your art is handled by this network. But if the artist stands as an endangered species in the face of contemporary economics and marketing, we are faced with a perplexing question. Why does the myth of the individual artist, the loner following his or her own heart, arise so predictably with each new generation? One possible answer is suggested by looking at the things that have made art worth doing in the past. Work that was driven by issues arising from the relationship between the artist and the work, or the artist and the materials, or the artist and the subject matter, rings true. Such work, regardless of whether it fits with then-contemporary attitudes, seems to continue to make sense over time. A second answer, more tentative, taps into the deep wellsprings of art, utility and ritual. In very early times, these basic needs provided the cultural niche for art, while self-expression, even if unrecognized as such, served to integrate personal experience and skill with those larger goals. But ritual, which took form as painted bison on the cave wall and found its high flowering in the time of the great religions, has receded into secular fad and decoration. And utility, in whose service the early artist gave form to every object from obsidian arrowheads to fired clay pottery, has yielded to complexity and mass production. In our time, the cultural niche for art remains unfulfilled, while self-expression has become an end in itself. This may not be the healthiest of situations, but then again, no one said we're living in the healthiest of times either. 7. The academic world. When my daughter was about 7 years old, she asked me one day what I did at work. I told her I worked at the college, that my job was to teach people how to draw. She stared back at me, incredulous, and said, "You mean they forget?" Howard Ikemoto. The authors would like to open this discussion with a radical proposition. Namely, that university art programs do serve some useful purpose. Admittedly, not a large purpose, and generally not their stated purpose. But some purpose. Now, that may not be exactly a ringing endorsement, but remember, we're talking here about a field whose most prominent graduates describe themselves as survivors of their formal education. Indeed, the thought of working in the art education system, either a student or faculty, may sound about as attractive as standing beneath a steady drizzle of dead cats. Viewed from the outside, most schooling gives every appearance of being not only destructive to the individual, but irrelevant to the great sweep of history as well. Horror stories abound. We've all been emotionally singed by some counterpart to the third-grade teacher who told certain kids they sang so badly they should just silently mouth the words of the Christmas pageant. Or some art history teacher who dismissed rock and roll or filmmaking with the backhanded one-liner, "It isn't art." Viewed from the inside, however, by those who grapple with educational issues on a day-to-day basis, things naturally get more complicated and personal. The dilemma facing academia is that it must accommodate not only students who are striving to become artists, but also teachers who are struggling to remain artists. Faculty issues. Ironically, the artist who would teach is often doomed before ever setting foot in the classroom. Appraisals of teaching ability get skewed during even the initial job selection process. Typical application forms allow few judgments about the quality of one's teaching, but routinely demand some arbitrary amount of same. This makes newly minted MFA graduates the perennial cannon fodder of the college job market, where they're routinely axed before ever landing their first position. Moreover, the same system that ignores the potential of the newcomer often discounts the achievements of the veteran. The author recalls once serving on a university search committee while it compared two applications. One, listing 3 years teaching for the local Parks and Recreation summer program. The other, attesting to an equivalent tenure on the art faculty at Harvard. Under state hiring guidelines, we were required to accord the two records equal ranking once the requirement for 3 years teaching experience had been met. Discriminating on the basis of quality was specifically forbidden. When teaching ability is relegated to a statistic, artistic ability becomes, somewhat surprisingly, an asset. As an aside, universities rarely have trouble attracting good artists. Art has the dubious distinction of being one profession in which you routinely earn more by teaching it than by doing it. Final selection often turns on the strength of one's standing in the art world. An impressive record of exhibition and publication, strong critical reviews, recognition from peers, honorary grants or fellowships, long-term involvement in the arts community, all these things help. In the best of all worlds, this would be a fine criterion. In the academic world, it's a setup for disaster. Higher education may excel in attracting a first-class artist, but it's rarely capable of supporting one. Viewing the scene neutrally, that is, at the purely structural level, the first breakpoint has simply to do with setting priorities. It is, after all, hard to imagine placing a full-time teaching career atop a full-time art-making career without something going awry in the process. As the old proverb cautions, if you chase two rabbits, you catch neither. Typically, the art-making rabbit disappears first. If you teach, you know the pattern already. By the end of the school week, you've little energy left for any art-making activity of more consequence than wedging clay or cleaning brushes. By the end of the term, nurturing unfinished work and frayed relationships may well take precedence over making any new art at all. The danger is real, and the examples many, that an artist who teaches will eventually dwindle away to something much less, a teacher who formerly made art. One-person shows become memories. Older work shuttles around a circuit of perfunctory group shows, and finally things just trail off entirely. Like some perverse recycling process from a sci-fi novel, the same system that produces new artists produces ex-artists. Needless to say, this scenario is fairly depressing. It is, however, neither absolute nor inevitable. For that matter, you might first ask yourself, what's wrong with producing less art? After all, your kids are important. Your job does serve a useful purpose. They deserve your time and energy, too. And beyond that, strategies do exist, artistic strategies, if you will, that allow for and even enhance your ability to make new art while working in an academic setting. One way or another, most all these strategies build upon the widespread consensus among artists that the single most redeeming feature of teaching is teaching. If you teach, you know that you gain as much from the interchange as do your students. The classroom studio, after all, gives you a forum where ideas are the coin of the realm. It allows you to draw energy from young minds filled with potential. It gives you a role in shaping the next generation of art. It keeps you alive. Teaching is part of the process of being an artist. The corollary here is that the greatest gift you have to offer your students is the example of your own life as a working artist. There's a story told about philosopher George Santayana that while teaching at Harvard, he was approached by a student who asked what courses he would be teaching the following term. Replied Santayana, Santayana 2, Santayana 2, and a seminar in Santayana 3. It's that basic. Your life is a paradigm of the process of being an artist, a witness and record to the way time and circumstance, event and emotion, courage and fear surround the making of art. Your experiences provide an affirmation to younger artists that the path they have chosen does lead somewhere, and that you are all really fellow travelers, separated only by the time you've already traveled down that path. What good teachers offer their students is something akin to the vulnerability found in a personal relationship, a kind of artistic and intellectual intimacy that lets others see how they reached a specific point, not simply that they did reach it. It is that willingness to lay open the line that runs between their life and their art that gives meaning to technique and empowerment to artistic goals that, for the student, may still lie many years distant. Learning is the natural reward of meetings with remarkable ideas and remarkable people. To share this as a teacher, your job, above all, is to maintain your autonomy, both as an artist and as a teacher. Maintaining that autonomy, however, is no easy matter. Obstacles to continued art-making are sometimes hardwired into academic policy. It is, for instance, the law in California that full-time instructors at state colleges be on campus every day of the week, even when they have no classes. With each day hopelessly fragmented, the large blocks of time essential to many art-making processes are irretrievably lost. And beyond that, time for both teaching and art-making must often be shored up against erosion from a steady river of administrative busy work. The magnitude of the problem varies widely. I recall that at the University of Oregon, art department meetings and memos routinely bled away 20 hours a week from otherwise useful time. I also recall, more fondly, that during an entire academic year at Stanford University, the art department scheduled exactly one meeting, and then canceled it for lack of a quorum. It's no fun fighting a two-front war, but one way or another, you have to preserve time both for making art and for sharing that art-making process with your students. Often the best strategy for cultivating quality time is to simply avoid, like the plague, all activities that don't. Artist and teacher Jack Wellpott, who for many years ran the photography program at San Francisco State University, provided the classic model for this approach. When asked how he managed to teach effectively and make art prolifically in the face of full-time faculty duties, Wellpott said, "From the day I was hired, I began cultivating a reputation within the art department of being sort of a flake. I found that after a year or two of losing track of my committee assignments, forgetting to answer memos and missing departmental meetings, well, after a while they just stopped asking me to do all those things." Student issues. Idealism has a high casualty rate. The chances are, statistically speaking, that if you're an artist, you're also a student. That says something very encouraging about the desire to learn art, and something very ominous about the attrition rate of those who try. There is, after all, a deadly corollary. Most people stop making art when they stop being students. Given that rather sobering reality check, our initial proposition, that art education does serve some useful purpose, triggers a flurry of student-related questions. Like, what exactly is that purpose? Why study art in an academic setting anyway? Or for that matter, what does it even mean to study art? Are you there to contemplate universal truths, explore new artistic frontiers, or breed fame and fortune? This contest to define the best framework for helping artists learn has been going on for at least a couple of centuries now, and chances are, surprise, that we won't suddenly resolve the issue in the next few sentences. You can corral good arguments, successful examples, prominent graduates, and insufferable converts to champion any of a whole flock of possible pathways. Ideally, your options range across colleges, art schools, workshops, apprenticeships, study tours, self-teaching, and more. Empirically, they implode to a field of two: the university and everything else. It's largely a question of structure. The strength of the university lies in the fact that you can study art, physics, anthropology, psychology, and literature all at once. The basic strength of the everything else, an apprenticeship, for instance, is that you can devote your energies solely to art all the time. Not surprisingly, each approach also carries built-in limitations. The university may prove too large and impersonal to nurture a young artist through long periods of self-doubt before craft and vision take hold. In addition, many university art courses are electives, their focus and intensity diluted by non-majors who bring no personal investment to the subject. If calculus were tailored as a fun elective for art majors, math majors would doubtless feel their studies were being retarded too. Conversely, a workshop or small conservatory may focus so tightly on art that you lose touch with larger worlds you need to explore. And in any case, the very structure that makes most art education work, a sheltered and supportive environment for art making, and an invitation to disengage for a time from the day-to-day treadmill of income production, vanishes instantly once you're out of school. The discouraging truth is that the rest of the world neither cares whether you make art, nor has much interest in buying it if you do. As far as most people are concerned, art may be acceptable as a profession, but certainly not as an occupation. Or, as one of the author's students dolefully pointed out, most professions come with a salary. Simply put, making art is not considered a real job. But then, the role of the university has always been to provide an education, which is a small but significant step removed from providing training. Training prepares you for a job. An education prepares you for life. But if the university lays the foundation for rich and interdisciplinary achievement over the long run, it's notorious for providing few employable skills in the short run. Art critic A.D. Coleman tells the story of a university art teacher who was frequently asked by anxious parents whether there would be jobs awaiting their children upon graduation. Invariably, the professor would reply, "Not as a direct result of anything they'll learn from me." This approach, however truthful, is rarely reassuring. Many students view graduating as tantamount to being pushed, unprepared, into some yawning abyss, forever. That prospect is daunting enough that many artists drop out before ever completing their studies. Others do graduate, but then, pressed by economics, find no way to continue art making afterwards. And yet others prolong the death watch by entering graduate programs. The latter approach, placed atop 15-odd years of already completed education, is superfluous at best and often actually harmful to the student's art-making capacity. Jerry Uhlsman refers to coaxing art from graduate students as a process of rehabilitating the overeducated. This whole scenario is a tragedy seldom addressed by academics, and even then is rarely acknowledged as a failure of the system. Watching from a safely tenured vantage point, the system instead laments the failure of the student. Poor therapists, I'm told, always blame their clients. Faced with such poor odds for artistic survival, much less success, upper division students migrate in droves toward the one job for artists that society does validate: teaching. This is a perilous course. There are many good reasons for wanting to teach, but avoiding the unknown is not one of them. The security of a monthly paycheck mixes poorly with the risk-taking of artistic inquiry. The discouraging truth is that MFA degrees were created largely to provide, and then satisfy, a prerequisite for obtaining teaching jobs. This, in effect, rendered the entire system a pyramid scheme. It worked only so long as there were a dozen entering freshmen to match with each graduating MFA. For better or worse, this pyramid began crumbling years ago. Today, art education is a steady-state universe, creating virtually no new jobs at all. Chances are, statistically speaking, that if you study art with the goal of teaching it, you'll end up with a career in sales. You study art making in order to learn about art making. Books about art. Books on art, even books on artists, characteristically have little to say about actually making art. They may offer a sprinkling of romantic parables about the artist's struggle, but the prevailing premise remains that art is clearly the province of genius, or, on occasion, madness. Accepting this premise leads inescapably to the conclusion that while art should be understood or enjoyed or admired by the reader, it most certainly should not be done by the reader. And once that kinship between reader and artist has been denied, art itself becomes a strange foreign object, something to be pointed to and poked at from a safe analytical distance. To the critic, art is a noun. Clearly, something's getting lost in the translation here. What gets lost quite specifically is the very thing artists spend the better part of their lives doing. Namely, learning to make work that matters to them. What artists learn from other artists is not so much history or technique, although we learn tons of that too. What we really gain from the art making of others is courage by association. Depth of contact grows as fears are shared and thereby disarmed. And this comes from embracing art as process, and artists as kindred spirits. To the artist, art is a verb. This distinction has substantial footing in the real world. Substantial enough, at least to support the provocative, if not entirely airtight, proposition that nothing really useful can be learned from viewing finished art. At least nothing other artists can usefully apply in making their own art. The really critical decisions facing every artist, like, say, knowing when to stop, cannot be learned from viewing end results. For that matter, a finished piece gives precious few clues as to any questions the artist weighed while making the object. You know how it is. In the heat of working, the thoughts in your head ricochet among a bewildering jumble of personal, shared, and universal concerns. But, oh yes, for each artist, a very specific jumble. And physically, you may be at your best when you're sweating in the sun, responding to a live audience, or, like the author as he writes this sentence, relaxing alone with a glass of wine. It's easy to imagine 100 different states of mind that might have led Edward Weston to photograph his garden vegetables. But we have not the faintest possibility of knowing whether our best guess from that 100 matched his actual state. And equally poor prospects that the resulting print will provide any guide to understanding the state of mind that transformed pepper number 30 into pepper number 30. This impasse may be what led Ezra Pound to remark that the one thing he learned from viewing a good piece of art was that the other artist had done his job well, and thus he, Pound, was freed to explore another direction. The art critic faces a more vexing dilemma. In a nutshell, he cannot explain the finished art piece from looking at the artist, and he cannot explain the artist by viewing the finished art piece. And so art is treated like some foreign object, analyzed from afar for its relationship to politics and culture and history, and, incestuously, to other art movements. Or more drudgerously catalogued into successive styles, periods, and masterworks. Textbooks compound the problem by reducing the history of art to the history of art that can be reproduced. Their mere miniatures and Bierstadt murals are allotted identical quarter-page niches, and art that doesn't lend itself to half-toning disappears entirely. We're not trying to set up straw men here, and certainly there's no harm in standing back occasionally to gain an overview of history and fantasize about your place in it. The point is simply that none of this will help you to get the paint to fall to the canvas the way you need it to. None of this will tell you what it's like to set the hammer to the marble for the first time. None of this will convey the terror of walking onto the stage to face 1,000 people. For the working artist, the very best writings on art are not analytical or chronological. They are autobiographical. The artist, after all, was there. An ancient tenet in Chinese painting holds that the master paints not the created thing, but the forces that created it. Likewise, the best writing about art depicts not the finished piece, but the processes that created it. In his day books, Edward Weston offered an intimate account, too intimate, some would say, of the myriad of influences bracketing the moment of exposure. In The Double Helix, Watson and Crick recorded, in more restrained style, the conjecture and experiments that led to their discovery of the molecular structure of DNA. In Daybook, artist Anne Truitt began a one-year journal, which in due time stretched to seven, filled with wisdom and insight. Weston's passion, Weston's logic, Truitt's introspection, these are all driving mechanisms of process. Every artist has issues that lie similarly close to the heart. Every artist could write such a book. You could write such a book. 8. Conceptual works. The answers you get depend upon the questions you ask. Thomas Kuhn. Writer Henry James once proposed three questions you could productively put to an artist's work. The first two were disarmingly straightforward. What was the artist trying to achieve? Did he or she succeed? The third's a zinger. Was it worth doing? Those first two questions alone are worth the price of admission. They address art at a level that can be tested directly against real-world values and experience. They commit you to accepting the perspective of the maker into your own understanding of the work. In short, they ask you to respond to the work itself, without first pushing it through some aesthetic filter labeled behaviorism, feminism, postmodernism, or whateverism. But it's that third question, was it worth doing, that truly opens the universe. What is worth doing? Are some artistic problems inherently more interesting than others, more relevant, more meaningful, more difficult, more provocative? Every contemporary artist dances with such questions as these. Ideas and technique. Provocative art challenges not only the viewer, but also its maker. Art that falls short often does so not because the artist failed to meet the challenge, but because there was never a challenge there in the first place. Think of it like Olympic diving. You don't win high points for making even the perfect swan dive off the low board. There's little reward in an easy perfection quickly reached by many. To resist models of perfection in art may seem strange, given their acceptance in so many other facets of living. Swan dives notwithstanding, the Olympic Games themselves are founded on the concept of great achievement within a strict framework. Honors in the 100-meter dash, after all, do not go to the runner who displays some intriguing personal skip, but to the one who reaches the set goal first. The burden for the artist, as Anne Truitt observes in her day book, is that the lawyer and the doctor practice their callings. The plumber and the carpenter know what they will be called upon to do. They do not have to spin the work out of themselves, discover its laws, and then present themselves turned inside out to the public gaze. Clearly, that is not an easy space to put yourself in, and indeed many artists don't. Artists who need ongoing reassurance that they're on the right track routinely seek out challenges that offer the clear goals and measurable feedback, which is to say, technical challenges. The underlying problem with this is not that the pursuit of technical excellence is wrong, exactly, but simply that making it the primary goal puts the cart before the horse. We do not long remember those artists who followed the rules more diligently than anyone else. We remember those who made the art from which the rules inevitably follow. More insidiously, technical standards have a way of taking on all the trappings of aesthetic standards. There is widespread agreement, for instance, that it's a genuine challenge to impart rich blacks and subtle high values to a photographic print. At some point, however, this seemingly neutral observation gave rise, especially among West Coast landscape photographers, to a moral imperative that photographs should display such tonal perfection. As this genre established itself, criteria for judging a print increasingly concentrated on the virtuoso technical performance needed to produce the desired tones. Subtlety of tone became, often quite literally, the primary content. An equivalent fate befell much 20th century symphonic music, which was seduced by arcane harmonic theory to the degree that its critical audience drifted progressively to other idioms, like jazz, that remained grounded in the rhythms of the real world. To the viewer who has little emotional investment in how the work gets done, art made primarily to display technical virtuosity is often beautiful, striking, elegant, and vacant. To the artist who has an emotional investment in everything, it's more a question of which direction to reach. Compared to other challenges, the ultimate shortcoming of technical problems is not that they're hard, but that they're easy. Artists, naturally, would be the last to admit that, if only because heroic accounts of grueling hours spent building the mold or casting the hot metal remain de rigueur of artistic conversation. But while mastering technique is difficult and time-consuming, it's still inherently easier to reach an already defined goal, a right answer, than to give form to a new idea. It's easier to paint in the angel's feet to another's masterwork than to discover where the angels live within yourself. If technique were the core issue in art, our nominee for the famous Artist's Wax Museum would be the lifer at San Quentin, who spent 20 years constructing a perfect replica of the Eiffel Tower from toothpicks. And, well, yes, in its own way, it was pretty impressive. But that's not the way it works. Simply put, art that deals with ideas is more interesting than art that deals with technique. Craft. Yes, there is a difference between art and craft. It's just that both terms are so overgrown with fuzzy definitions that drawing a clear distinction between them is close to impossible. We'll settle here for a fuzzy distinction. Think of craft, and you think of furniture shaped by Sam Maloof, of handmade clothing flaunted at Renaissance fairs, of everything made before the Industrial Revolution. Think of art, and you think of War and Peace, a Beethoven concerto, the Mona Lisa. Both disciplines obviously yield good things, valuable things, sometimes tangibly useful things, and at first pass the distinction between them seems perfectly clear. But is the Mona Lisa really art? Well then, what about an undetectably perfect copy of the Mona Lisa? That comparison, however sneaky, points up the fact that it's surprisingly difficult, maybe even impossible, to view any single work in isolation and rule definitively. This is art, or this is craft. Striking that difference means comparing successive pieces made by the same person. In essence, art lies embedded in the conceptual leap between pieces, not in the pieces themselves. And simply put, there's a greater conceptual jump from one work of art to the next than from one work of craft to the next. The net result is that art is less polished, but more innovative than craft. The differences between five Steinway grand pianos, demonstrably works of consummate craftsmanship, are small compared to the differences between the five Beethoven piano concerti you might perform on those instruments. A work of craft is typically made to fit a specific template, sometimes a painstakingly difficult template requiring years of hands-on apprenticeship to master. It's staggering to realize that nearly all the truly great violins ever produced were made in the course of a few years by a few artisans living within a few blocks of each other. All this in a remote Italian village 3 centuries ago. The accomplishments of Antonio Stradivari and his fellow craftsmen point up one real difference between art and craft. With craft, perfection is possible. In that sense, the Western definition of craft closely matches the Eastern definition of art. In Eastern cultures, art that faithfully carries forward the tradition of an elder master is honored. In the West, it is put down as derivative. Yet curiously, the progression of most artists' work over time is a progression from art toward craft. In the same manner that imagination gives way to execution as any single work builds toward completion, an artist's major discoveries usually come early on, and a lifetime is then allotted to fill out and refine those discoveries. As the Zen proverb suggests, for the beginner there are many paths, for the advanced, few. At any point along that path, your job as an artist is to push craft to its limits, without being trapped by it. The trap is perfection. Unless your work continually generates new and unresolved issues, there's no reason for your next work to be any different from the last. The difference between art and craft lies not in the tools you hold in your hands, but in the mental set that guides them. For the artisan, craft is an end in itself. For you, the artist, craft is the vehicle for expressing your vision. Craft is the visible edge of art. New work. In routine artistic growth, new work doesn't make the old work false. It makes it more artificial, more an act of artifice. Older work is oftentimes an embarrassment to the artist because it feels like it was made by a younger, more naive person, one who was ignorant of the pretension and striving in the work. Earlier work often feels, curiously, both too labored and too simple. This is normal. New work is supposed to replace old work. If it does so by making the old work inadequate, insufficient, and incomplete, well, that's life. Frank Lloyd Wright advised young architects to plant ivy all around their early buildings, suggesting that in time it would grow to cover their youthful indiscretions. Old work tells you what you were paying attention to then. New work comments on the old by pointing out what you were not previously paying attention to. Now, this would all be smooth and lovely, except that new work can turn to old work in an instant. Sometimes, indeed, in the instant immediately following the work's completion. Savoring finished work may last only an eye blink. This is certainly unpleasant, but it's a good sign. Creativity. Listeners may wish to note that nowhere in this book is the dreaded C-word used. Why should it? Do only some people have ideas, confront problems, dream, live in the real world, and breathe air? Habits. Habits are the peripheral vision of the mind. Churning away just below the level of conscious decision-making, they scan a situation with a conceptual eye to disregarding most of it. The theory is simple enough. Respond automatically to the familiar, and you're then free to respond selectively to the unfamiliar. Applying that theory, however, is a bit dicier. Indulge too many habits, and life sinks into mind-dulling routine. Too few, and coping with a relentless stream of incoming detail overwhelms you, much as users of certain psychotropic drugs become mesmerized once they notice that every blade of grass is growing. It's all a matter of balance, and making art helps achieve that balance. For the artist, a sketch pad or a notebook is a license to explore. It becomes entirely acceptable to stand there, for minutes on end, staring at a tree stump. Sometimes you need to scan the forest, sometimes you need to touch a single tree. If you can't apprehend both, you'll never entirely comprehend either. To see things is to enhance your sense of wonder, both for the singular pattern of your own experience and for the meta-patterns that shape all experience. All this suggests a useful working approach to making art. Notice the objects you notice. Or, put another way, make objects that talk, and then listen to them. Habits get a lot of bad press in the art world. Well, no surprises there. In a field where iconoclasts flourish and exploring new ideas is the order of the day, who wants to stay home with the familiar? Indeed, why should you? After all, if you're comfortable with what you're doing, you've probably been there before. Yet larger questions will never get engaged unless huge amounts of detail can be trusted to habit. If art is to nourish consciousness, Habitual reactions must be encouraged as well as questioned. The need is to search among your own repeated reactions to the world, expose those that are not true or useful, and change them. The remainder are yours. Cultivate them. In any case, you haven't much choice. As mathematician G.K. Chesterton wryly noted, you can free things from alien or accidental laws, but not from the laws of their own nature. Do not go about encouraging triangles to break out of the prison of their three sides. If a triangle breaks out of its three sides, its life comes to a lamentable end. The trick, of course, is cultivating habitual gestures that are yours. Unfortunately, the outside world is not overly charitable to the artist in this effort. Habits imprinted by genes, parents, church, jobs, and relationships are called character traits. Habits acquired from other artists are called, depending on the form they take, affectation, derivation, plagiarism, or forgery. Your authors find this judgment a trifle harsh, especially since it invalidates the very source artists most often draw from in their early art-making. The effect on the artist, however, isn't nearly so dire as critics would have it appear. Many people first respond deeply to art, indeed respond deeply to the world, upon finding works of art that seem to speak directly to them. Small surprise, then, if upon setting out to make art themselves, they begin by emulating the art or artist that brought this revelation. Beethoven's early compositions, for instance, show the unmistakable influence of his teacher, Franz Joseph Haydn. Most early work, in fact, only hints at the themes and gestures that will, if the potential isn't squandered, emerge as the artist's characteristic signature in later mature work. At the outset, however, chances are that whatever theme and technique attract you, someone has already experimented in the same direction. This is unavoidable. Making any art piece inevitably engages the large themes and basic techniques that artists have used for centuries. Finding your own work is a process of distilling from each those traces that ring true to your own spirit. Once developed, art habits are deep-seated, reliable, helpful, and convenient. Moreover, habits are stylistically important. In a sense, habits are style. The unconsidered gesture, the repeated phrasing, the automatic selection, the characteristic reaction to subject matter and materials, these are the very things we refer to as style. Lots of people, artists included, consider this a virtue. Viewed closely, however, style is not a virtue. It is an inevitability, the inescapable result of doing anything more than a few times. The habitual gestures of the artist appear throughout any body of work developed enough to be called a body of work. Style is not an aspect of good work, it is an aspect of all work. Style is the natural consequence of habit. Art and Science. It is an article of faith among artists and scientists alike that at some deep level their disciplines share a common ground. What science bears witness to experimentally, art has always known intuitively, that there is an innate rightness to the recurring forms of nature. Science does not set out to prove the existence of parabolas or sine curves or pi, yet wherever phenomena are observed, there they are. Art does not weigh mathematically the outcome of the brushstroke, yet whenever artworks are made, archetypal forms appear. Charles Eames, when asked just how he arrived at the curves used in his famous molded plywood chair, was clearly baffled that anyone would ask such a question. Finally, he just shrugged and replied, "It's in the nature of the thing." Some things, regardless of whether they are discovered or invented, simply and assuredly feel right. What is natural and what is beautiful are, in their purest state, indistinguishable. Could you improve upon the circle? In the day-to-day world, however, improving the circle is different from, say, improving the wheel. Science advances at the rate that technology provides tools of greater precision, while art advances at the pace that evolution provides minds with greater insight. A pace that is, for better or worse, glacially slow. Thus, while the stone tools fashioned by cave dwellers an ice age ago are hopelessly primitive by current technological standards, their wall paintings remain as elegant and expressive as any modern art. And while 100 civilizations have prospered, sometimes for centuries, without computers or windmills or even the wheel, none have survived even a few generations without art. All that is not meant to cast art and science into some sort of moral foot race, but simply to point out that, in art as well as in science, the answers you get depend upon the questions you ask. Where the scientist asks what equation would best describe the trajectory of an airborne rock, the artist asks what it would feel like to throw one. The main thing to keep in mind, as Douglas Hofstadter noted, is that science is about classes of events, not particular instances. Art is just the opposite. Art deals in any one particular rock with its welcome vagaries, its peculiarities of shape, its unevenness, its noise. The truths of life as we experience them, and as art expresses them, include random and distracting influences as essential parts of their nature. Theoretical rocks are the province of science. Particular rocks are the province of art. The richness of science comes from really smart people asking precisely framed questions about carefully controlled events. Controlled in the sense that such random or distracting influences don't count. The scientist, if asked whether a given experiment could be repeated with identical results, would have to say yes, or it wouldn't be a science. The presumption is that at the end of a scientific experiment, neither the researcher nor the world have changed, and so repeating the experiment would necessarily reproduce the same result. Indeed, anyone performing the experiment correctly would get the same results, a circumstance that on occasion leads to multiple claims for the same discovery. But the artist, if asked whether an art piece could be remade with identical results, would have to answer no, or it wouldn't be art. In making a piece of art, both the artist and the artist's world are changed. And re-asking the question, facing the next blank canvas, will always yield a different answer. This creates a certain paradox, for while good art carries a ring of truth to it, a sense that something permanently important about the world has been made clear, the act of giving form to that truth is arguably unique to one person and one time. There is a moment for each artist in which a particular truth can be found, and if it is not found then, it will not ever be. No one else will ever be in a position to write Hamlet. This is pretty good evidence that the meaning of the world is made, not found. Our understanding of the world changed when those words were written, and we can't go back, any more than Shakespeare could. The world thus altered becomes a different world, with our alterations being part of it. The world we see today is the legacy of people noticing the world and commenting on it in forms that have been preserved. Of course it's difficult to imagine that horses had no shape before someone painted their shape on the cave walls, but it is not difficult to see the world became a subtly larger, richer, more complex and meaningful place as a result. Self-reference. Self-reference, repetition, parody, satire. Art is nothing if not incestuous. Witness Escher's drawing of hands drawing hands. 20th century art has made self-reference pretty much its stock in trade. Paintings about painting, writings about writing. Moreover, most every piece of art quotes itself, calling out its own name through rhythm and repetition. Music offers the clearest examples, like Beethoven building the first movement of his Fifth Symphony around just four notes. But all media have their equivalents. When not quoting itself, artworks often pay homage to art that preceded them. Shostakovich's masterful Viola Sonata, Opus 147, quotes Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, wrapping the tune around itself, drawing attention to itself, drawing attention to something else. At the less reverent level, this becomes satire and parody, as in Woody Allen's Play It Again, Sam. An operation like, for instance, applying paint, says something not only about itself, but about all the other applied paint as well. Rembrandt's work looks different, the paint more deliberately applied after you've seen Jackson Pollock's. It looks even more different after you've applied paint yourself. Our understanding of the past is altered by our experiences in the present. Turning the reference point inward, it's apparent that at some level, all art is autobiographical. After all, your brush only paints a stroke in response to your gesture. Your word processor only taps out a sentence in response to your keystrokes. As Tennessee Williams observed, even works of demonstrable fiction or fantasy remain emotionally autobiographical. John Sharkowski once curated a show at the Museum of Modern Art titled Mirrors and Windows. His premise was that some artists view the world as if looking through a window at things happening out there, while others view the world as if looking in a mirror at a world inside themselves. Either way, the autobiographical vantage point is implicit. If art is about self, the widely accepted corollary is that making art is about self-expression. And it is, but that is not necessarily all it is. It may only be a passing feature of our times that validating the sense of who you are is held up as the major source of the need to make art. What gets lost in that interpretation is an older sense that art is something you do out in the world, or something you do about the world, or even something you do for the world. The need to make art may not stem solely from the need to express who you are, but from a need to complete a relationship with something outside yourself. As a maker of art, you are custodian of issues larger than self. Some people who make art are driven by inspiration, others by provocation, still others by desperation. Art making grants access to worlds that may be dangerous, sacred, forbidden, seductive, or all of the above. It grants access to worlds you may otherwise never fully engage. It may, in fact, be the engagement, not the art, that you seek. The difference is that making art allows, indeed guarantees, that you declare yourself. Art is contact, and your work necessarily reveals the nature of that contact. In making art, you declare what is important. Metaphor. When you start on a long journey, trees are trees, water is water, and mountains are mountains. After you have gone some distance, trees are no longer trees, water no longer water, mountains no longer mountains. But after you have traveled a great distance, trees are once again trees, water is once again water, mountains are once again mountains. Zen teaching. Making art depends upon noticing things. Things about yourself, your methods, your subject matter. Sooner or later, for instance, every visual artist notices the relationship of the line to the picture's edge. Before that moment, the relationship does not exist. Afterward, it's impossible to imagine it not existing. And from that moment on, every new line talks back and forth with the picture's edge. People who have not yet made this small leap do not see the same picture as those who have. In fact, conceptually speaking, they do not even live in the same world. Your work is the source for an uncountably large number of such relationships. And these relationships, in turn, are a primary source of the richness and complexity in your art. As your art develops, conceptual relationships increasingly define the shape and structure of the world you see. In time, they are the world. Distinctions between you, your work, and the world lessen, grow transparent, and finally disappear. In time, trees are once again trees. Viewed over a span of years, changes in one's art often reveal a curious pattern, swinging irregularly between long periods of quiet refinement and occasional leaps of runaway change. And though it's beyond our purposes here, we can't help but note the tantalizing similarity between this pattern and the manifestations of chaos theory in mathematics. Sometimes our perception of the world flows smoothly and continuously from one state to the next, and sometimes it flips over unexpectedly and irrevocably into a different configuration entirely. As school kids, we memorize the famous examples, like Newton's apple delivering him the law of gravity, but always with the caveat that such events are rare, probably excessively rare. After all, how often does anyone get the chance to rewrite the underlying laws of physics? Yet it's demonstrably true that all of us do, from time to time, experience such conceptual jumps, and while ours may not affect the orbit of planets, they markedly affect the way we engage the world around us. Study French, for instance, and you'll likely spend the first month painstakingly translating it word by word into English to make it understandable. Then one day, voila, you find yourself reading French without translating it, and a process that was previously enigmatic has become automatic. Or go mushroom hunting with someone who really knows mushrooms, and you'll first endure some downright humiliating outings in which the expert finds all the mushrooms, and you find none. But then, at some point, the world shifts. The woods magically fill. Mushrooms everywhere. And a view that was previously opaque has become transparent. For the artist, such lightning shifts are a central mechanism of change. They generate the purest form of metaphor. Connections are made between unlike things. Meanings from one enrich the meanings of the other. And the unlike things become inseparable. Before the leap, there was light and shadow. Afterwards, objects float in a space where light and shadow are indistinguishable from the object they define. Recently, a painter of some accomplishment, but as insecure as the rest of us, was discussing his previous night's dream with a friend over coffee. It was one of those vivid technicolor dreams, the kind that linger on in exact detail even after waking. In his dream, he found himself at an art gallery. And when he walked inside and looked around, he found the walls hung with paintings, amazing paintings, paintings of passionate intensity and haunting beauty. Recounting his dream, the artist ended fervently with, "I'd give anything to be able to make paintings like that." "Wait a minute," his friend exclaimed. "Don't you see? Those were your paintings. They came from your own mind. Who else could have painted them?" Who else, indeed? Of course, you can deny your dreams, but the result will be uniformly dreary. Insist that the world must always remain X, and X is indeed exactly what you'll get. But that's all the world will ever be. And all your art will ever be. When your only tool is a hammer, so the saying goes, everything looks like a nail. Imagination and execution take their rightful common ground in possible acts, paintable pictures, danceable steps, playable notes. Your growth as the artist is a growth toward fully realizable works, works that become real in full illumination of all that you know, including all you know about yourself. 9. The human voice. Computers are useless. All they can give you are answers. Pablo Picasso. Throughout much of this book, we've tried to confront the difficulties of making art by examining the way those difficulties really happen in the studio. It's a simple premise. Follow the leads that arise from contact with the work itself, and your technical, emotional, and intellectual pathway becomes clear. Having come this far, it's tempting to try to bring this idea to closure, by resolving all those leads into a single, clear, concise, fundamental, finely honed answer. Tempting, but futile. Answers are reassuring. But when you're on to something really useful, it will probably take the form of a question. Questions. Over the long run, the people with the